coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us today Mr. George Anastasia. We're going to be talking about his latest book. It's called The Last Gangster. And it's the story of a fellow named Previtt, Ron, Big Ron Previtt, who was he was a crook. He was a mobster. He was a policeman, he was an FBI informant. It's a fascinating book going into the really what happened to the mob in Philadelphia. Mr. Anastasia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, how did you happen to write this book about Big Ron Previtt?
Well, I'm a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and my beat is organized crime. So I was writing about him as this whole story was unfolding in the newspapers.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about him, and then, of course, we're going to be bringing some other stations on in a couple of minutes, but just give us an overview, and then we'll try to get people to understand who this man was. He really wasn't a very nice man in a lot of ways. He was a total opportunist. He had no moral foundation at all, and yet, of course, he played an important part in putting down the Philadelphia mob.
Yeah, Ron Previtt was a 6 foot, 300-pound underworld mercenary. I think that's the best way to describe it. He moved in all kinds of circles, but his loyalty was only to himself. And he saw his agreement to cooperate with authorities as an insurance policy, his way out when, you know, when the game was up. And he was clever enough and smart enough to see, like a chess player looking five or six moves down the road, that eventually he would need to use that insurance to get out from underneath what he was dealing with.
And really, the point you made out, I thought was really so interesting, that is the mob that at one time had been, you know, very, very powerful and had a certain code of honor and integrity, at least, you know, as much as you can when you're a gangster and killing your opponents. This had all gone, and now it was simply based upon greed and avarice, and the honor of the old Sicilian mafia really was no more. Wasn't that one of the things that sort of disillusioned Big Ron?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was a guy who grew up and aspired to be a wise guy. He wanted to be a member of the mafia. That was one of his goals in life. And he, in speaking to me, he told me basically when he got there, when he finally became a made member of the organization, he realized he was about 20 years too late. He would have been a good gangster, good in the is an operative word, but a good gangster in the 40s or 50s.
And, of course, he was the sort of guy who was an enforcer. He'd break people's legs, beat them up, you know, just terrorize people into doing whatever he or his mob masters wanted them to do.
Exactly. And he also was, he knew how to generate money. He knew how to work underworld businesses, whether it's prostitution, drug dealing, gambling, loan sharking. He understood the whole economics of the underworld. And basically what he said was when he got involved with the mafia in Philadelphia, he realized the guys running the show didn't get that. They didn't understand it. All they were about was robbing one another, grabbing the money, spending the money. They had no kind of long-range thinking, long-range planning. And it disillusioned him.
And there really was no honor there among them. They were quite willing to kill anybody who got into their way.
Well, that's been the story of the Philadelphia mob for the past 15 years, and it's why I think the Philadelphia crime family is kind of a microcosm of the American mafia in general. And if you want to know why it's come apart at the seams, look to Philadelphia and you get an understanding of what's happened across the country. It's all about the lack of honor.
And one of the things you point out is that sort of they've killed off, they've destroyed the good, I shouldn't say the good gene pool, but at least the gene pool that at once made the mafia something to be feared, and of course has pretty well destroyed it. And of course this is what happens when you get into this rampant killing. My fear is the same thing that happens to nations when they get into rapid killing and, of course, kill off the best and the bravest, and the cowards stay at home. We'll be right back here with George Anastasia talking about The Last Gangster. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon is George Anastasia, who's a writer, a crime reporter for the works at a newspaper in Philadelphia. In his book, The Last Gangster, is the story of Big Ron Previte. Do you pronounce it Previte or Previte?
Previte.
Previte. Previte. Previte, Big Ron Previte. And he was, of course, a gangster. He was a police officer. He was an FBI informant. He was a member of the mob. And it gives this entire background of what's happening to the Cosa Nostra here in the United States. And what was once a very effective organization really is pretty much destroyed in this country, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think in part it's because of the sophisticated operations of the FBI and federal prosecutors. But in part, it's kind of death by suicide, self-inflicted wounds of arrogance and treachery and greed. It's contributed in large degree to its own demise. The whole idea of honor and loyalty, if it ever existed, I think disappeared about a generation ago.
And one of the points you make out is that Big Ron Previte actually had a deal, first of all, with the local sheriff's office or police, and then with the FBI, where he could go out and he could do whatever he wanted to. He could beat people up. He could run prostitution. He could do whatever he wanted to, as long as he didn't kill anybody, and as long as he kept giving them information. They gave him sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card, didn't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the deal that they made, and basically the way they justify that is the only way Previte is going to be in a position to supply them with information about the underworld is if he's operating in the underworld, and the only way he can operate in the underworld is to do what he had always done. So yeah, he did have kind of carte blanche, and they drew the line that, you know, they don't want you to be whacking anybody.
And
Previte himself, you know, he says he's never killed anybody. I believe him when he says that, and it wasn't a question of moral compunction. It just was, he realized it's excess baggage that he didn't need.
Of course, you point out that in Boston, why the FBI up there was backing a guy who was killing somebody. That was Whitey Bulger.
Yeah.
And he killed 20 people, tortured them to death while he had a get-out-of-jail-free card from the FBI. That was a little embarrassing because that went right up to J. Edgar Hoover, didn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's, I think, the most egregious example of how, and it happened to a lesser degree in Philadelphia, how the FBI falls in love with their informants and loses sight of what it's all about. I mean, you've got to have lines. You've got to have areas where you can't let your guy go, even when he's supplying you with information. And I think in Boston, in that Whitey Bulger case, they crossed the line repeatedly, and people ended up dead as a result.
And
I think in Philadelphia, you know, Previte went right up to the line, but I don't think he ever crossed over the line.
But this went on for 20 years. That's the most incredible. That was the story of in Boston.
Right.
How long was Previte at work in Philadelphia?
Previte began cooperating with the FBI around 1993.
Hold that thought right there. Okay, this is Dr. Stan, and of course we're talking with our special guest this afternoon, George Anastasia. We're talking about Big Ron Previte, who is a mobster par excellence, but he also had a get-out-of-jail-free card because he eventually was working with the FBI, and he could do whatever he wanted to as long as he didn't kill anybody, just about whatever he wanted to. And so he was running prostitution, he was running, gambling, he was running all sorts of dishonest things, and he was working with the top mob dons there in Philadelphia. And what's really so fascinating about your book, I mean, we hear about the bumbling FBI, gee, they had no idea what was going on with the terrorists, but they knew everything that was going on with these mobsters. I mean, they were tapping their telephones, they were tapping their lawyers' offices, they were tapping the conversations from prison. They had, of course, Big Ron there wearing a wire. They had literally thousands of hours of interviews, incriminating interviews, didn't they?
Absolutely. I mean, Previte himself recorded over 400 conversations, and prior to Previte wearing a wire, as you said, they had phones tapped, they had rooms bugged, they had meetings bugged. So there were voluminous transcripts of these guys incriminating themselves. And you know, I've covered enough trials to know that one of the hardest things for a defense attorney to do is to cross-examine a tape. You can't do that. Your client's on tape saying, we're going to whack so-and-so. So-and-so ends up dead. It's very little you can do in terms of a defense of that. And those are the kind of tapes that were made in this case and in others that I've seen. And, yeah, the FBI has become very adept at bringing down the mob. The problem in terms of the terrorists is they don't have the kind of inside information to get inside the organizations, to get bugs in place, to have people wired. I mean, we haven't reached that point in the attack on terrorism. And it's this frightening kind of thing, because I think the gangsters of the 21st century are the terrorists, not the mafia.
All right, so we're getting a good insight into how effective the FBI is, at least as far as their handling of the mobsters. And aren't most of the major dons of the Cosa Nostra now in prison?
Yeah, I mean, I think the leaders of all the five New York families have taken a hit. They've all been jailed. There's always somebody who, you know, assumes the top spot after that. But in Philadelphia, in the 15 years that I've been writing about this, there's been three mob bosses killed, three others have been jailed, and a fourth one is in jail and cooperating. So that's seven mafia dons in Philadelphia in that time frame have either ended up dead or in jail. It's very short-lived. It's not a job that anyone ought to aspire to.
It's rather a short time. You may have good benefits while you're there, but you're not going to be there for very long.
Exactly.
And really, the ruthless way in which these people kill one another, and they'll invite them over for a meeting to establish peace, and then they'll whack them. And I think that's the term they use, whack them.
That's correct, yeah.
And, of course, this went right down to Atlantic City, didn't it?
Well, Atlantic City was a big part of the Philadelphia story. The Philadelphia crime family has always had Atlantic City as part of its domain. And when casino gambling was authorized in New Jersey in 1976, that really upped the stakes in terms of Philadelphia's value in the underworld and what different mobsters were fighting for, because Atlantic City is a major money-making source for organized crime. So things changed after that casino gambling referendum, and violence followed in the kind of the different guys vying for power and position, whether they were Philadelphia guys or guys from New York trying to come down and get a piece of the pie that all of a sudden became more desirable because of what was going on in Atlantic City. And Cromedy was in the middle of all of that.
And really, it was fascinating when he talked about when he was a police officer. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that? Because, as he said, I was a good police officer. I didn't bother innocent people.
He makes that distinction. He said, I was a good cop, I enforced the law, but I also was a crook. And by that he meant, you know, he'd arrest drug dealers, he'd run into burning buildings to rescue somebody in trouble, but he also always had his hand out. He took bribes from mob guys, he took bribes from pimps and prostitutes, he took bribes from drug dealers. It depended on the given day and the given situation. But he said when he became a police officer in the 1970s, that was part of the culture of the department back then. He broke in under a group of older police officers who were always looking for an angle, always looking for a way to make a buck. He said the goal of every police officer was not to cash your paycheck. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He says, well, you just deposit your paycheck in the bank and you get your spending money out on the streets each week. Said, that was the goal. And it's that kind of mentality. He said, I learned more about being a crook during the 12 years I was a cop than any other time in my life.
What a sad commentary that is.
Well,
you know,
yeah.
This is the way I know Chicago was for many years. That was pretty well cleaned up by the 60s. Maybe at least it seemed to be pretty well cleaned up by the middle 60s. But this was going on in Philadelphia in the 70s?
That would be in the 70s. And they had there was a cleaning house in the late 70s, early 80s. Previty was asked to resign. He took a partial disability and he left the force in 1979, 1980. It was one of those things where they knew what he was doing, they couldn't prove it, but he knew his days were limited, so he agreed to walk away. It was a mutual parting of the ways. And the department, I don't think the Department of Philadelphia is today the way it was back in Previty's day.
Well, fortunately, at least in little town where I live, this sort of thing hasn't gone on for many years. And it's great to live in a place where you can trust the police. If you can't trust the police, you're in real trouble.
Well, that's a fundamental problem if that happens.
Now, you tell about the story when he, of course, was then he went to work as a security guard in a big casino there in Atlantic City, and he's in charge of security, and he's stealing everything he can, manipulating.
Yeah.
Just tell a little bit. That's a fascinating part of the story, how he was able to work every angle when he was in charge of security to make sure that no crime was going on.
Right. He was able to segue from the police department where he left, at least on paper, on relatively good terms, and he got a job as security officer with the Tropicana Casino Hotel in Atlantic City. This is in 1981 when the casino was about to open. And I remember, because I was working in Atlantic City back then, there was a rush to complete that casino and get it open, because the casinos were making money hand over fist, and everybody was trying to get a gaming house running. So Previty's first job is in the warehouse, kind of the staging area, as they're doing this construction. And he worked the midnight to 8 shift in the warehouse. And basically, on his shift, things kept going out the back door. He had a friend who had a restaurant in Hamilton, New Jersey, furnished the entire restaurant with Tropicana silverware, Tropicana glasses, Tropicana dishes. Everything from the Tropicana ended up in this guy's restaurant. He was selling stuff right and left out of the warehouse. And then from there, once the casino opened, he was a security guard on the casino floor and was working all kind of scams. He was running a prostitution ring where he would take a couple empty rooms each night and have hookers working out of the rooms. He and a desk clerk had a deal with one another where if a high roller came in and was comped at the casino, say the guy's comped for 4 days, he decides to leave after 2 days, they would hold the room, keep the room, sell it to someone else. That individual would pay them cash for the room and then be able to use the comp to order room service or whatever free on the casino tab that the high roller had, but it was no longer in the room. They would rob safety deposit boxes by manipulating the security camera so that they could get access to the safes. And he said there was, casinos were so concerned about their reputation that if somebody's safety deposit box was robbed, a customer, the casino would make good on what was ever stolen because they didn't want word to get out that it was unsafe there because customers would go to another casino. So Previty was able to manipulate every situation to take advantage of it. And he says he literally made millions during the 5 years he was a casino worker. And at the same time, I mean, and this is the amazing thing about this guy, the chutzpah, the arrogance of this guy. He's working as a casino security guard for $20,000 a year. And some nights he would leave his shift, change out of his uniform, put on his fancy clothes, his gold chains, wait outside while a limo from another casino would come and pick him up and take him over to the other casino where he was a high roller and where he would gamble at the craps table $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 in a night. This is on a $20,000 a year salary. And he said, obviously there's something wrong with that picture, but nobody was picking up on it. And that's the way he lived for about 5 years down there.
And then eventually they must have...
they also asked him to leave, yes.
but of course, when they finally got him dead to rights, the sheriff's office, the police office?
New Jersey State Police.
And they made him an offer that it was pretty hard to refuse. You want to go into that? Because here's this guy, he's just a thug, he's a crook, he's a hoodlum, and yet he's smart enough when he's given an offer that he may be able to get some immunity if he starts squealing on all these other people who trust him, all these other hoods, he decides to play both sides of the fence.
Exactly. He's jammed up at the end of about 5 years at the casino. They've known for several years that he's doing stuff that can't quite prove it. And he gets nailed one night where he's got room keys to a couple hotels that he's using for his hookers. He's got a small quantity of marijuana in his pocket that was for one of his customers. And he's got some football betting pools. And so they nab him on those charges and they sit him down in a room and... they tell him, look, we can charge you with this, or we can work out a deal. And he hears what the deal is, and the deal is he resigns as a casino employee, agrees never again to work in a casino, and he becomes an informant for the New Jersey State Police, in exchange for which they'll let him walk away. And he said he decided it was time to go, and he thought cooperating with the state police was, how do you put it, it was another tool in his toolbox. He was able to use that. So he began informing on drug dealers, car theft rings, the people in the underworld who he associated with.
The people who trusted him.
Well, the people who he did business with, or perhaps who were his competitors. You know, in a lot of ways, it makes good business sense. You get your competitors out of the way, you're going to do better yourself. So it's always, I mean, Ron Previty, his loyalty was only to the face he saw in the mirror each morning when he was shaving.
And this was his statement, wasn't it?
Yes.
And he didn't make any excuses for himself. He said he was a crook. He knew he was a crook, and he just wanted to play it as well as he could. And when he was able to cooperate then with the police, and then let him go ahead and continue being a crook and running all these illegal activities, this was the greatest thing in the world.
Well, sure, that was his insurance policy. And I mean, there are many interesting things about Previty, but the thing that struck me, I've written about and covered a lot of mob informants, and most of them, when they agree to cooperate, when they get up on the witness stand, they talk about this epiphany that they've had and that they realize how horrible they had been and they want to put that life behind them. Never got that from Previty. Previty was very matter of fact. This is who I was. This is what I did. This is the deal I made, and I'm up here testifying because it was part of my agreement. But I don't regret anything that I did. I was a crook. I was a good crook. I was very good at what I did. And there was a certain, honesty is probably the wrong word, but there was a certain truthfulness about that was, on some levels, appealing. I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. He is what he is.
And we'll be back here in just a moment or two with George Anastasia, the book, The Last Gangster. Fascinating read.
Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. A secret of healthy aging was recently found among people who have lived unusually long, healthy lives. The longest-lived woman, Jean Calment of France, who lived 122 years, and man, Antonio Todd of the Italian Isle of Sardinia, who lived 115 years, as well as the Queen Mother of England, who lived 100 years, outliving one of her daughters by 3 decades, was their daily consumption of red wine. But health authorities have been reticent to recommend an alcoholic beverage to the public at large until now. Longevinex is the world's first stabilized French red wine extract in a pill, without the calories and without the alcohol or sulfite preservatives. One Longevinex capsule provides the red wine molecules found in 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000. 4,000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763. 9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I want to tell you about the Miracle 2 soap products that we carry here, and we can't make any medical claims for them. We can only tell you that a lot of people tell us that they get great results using these various products as far as rashes are concerned. Certainly, our good friend Joyce Riley gives these products to Gulf War veterans for the rashes that they have, and so many of them have had rashes, and nothing helps them, and they use the Miracle 2 soap products, the moisturizing soap and the gel, and well, they say that the rash gets better. All we can do is suggest you might try it. We've had people tell us the rash has improved, or the acne has improved. Some girls feel this has really helped their acne. We'd love to know if you've had any good results with it. But we can tell you that it's excellent soap, and I wouldn't be without our Miracle 2 soap products, nor would my wife. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And just call in and ask for our Miracle 2 soap products. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is George Anastasia. We're talking about his book, The Last Gangster. And this is a fascinating individual, a man almost without a conscience, a man who is totally self-centered. He eventually, of course, lost his family. But he made literally millions of dollars, first of all as a crooked cop, and then as a crooked a security guard, and then as a crooked mobster, and eventually he got right up into the very top levels of the Cosa Nostra, and where he was, of course, informing the FBI on everything that was done, and he was wearing a wire for over 400 interviews. Now, that certainly could have gotten him killed, couldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, every time he was strapped on that wire, he was putting his life on the line, and that's the way the FBI justified the amount of money they paid him. The FBI paid him about $1 million over a 10-year period, the bulk of it coming in the last 2 years while he was wearing a wire.
Well, now, what about the idea that, you know, his life is in danger? Certainly, aren't there a lot of people that'd like to just do him in for being what he is?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the other interesting thing about him is that he has not left the area. Brevity opted not to go into the witness protection program, and he stayed in this general Philadelphia, South Jersey area. I had lunch with him last week. He's basically said, you know, I did what I did, and I'm going to live my life on my terms. And every day that he gets up and goes out, his life is on the line. But I think knowing him and knowing his character, I mean, I think part of, I guess, what makes his juices flow, part of what gets his blood pumping is living life on the edge. He spent 30, 35 years in the underworld where every day he was living on the edge. And I think the only thing that keeps him going now is that he's on the edge because he knows, you know, his life's on the line. And I couldn't live like that, but I think that's part of his makeup.
And actually, he was featured on 60 Minutes. That's where I first heard about him. And they
about a month ago. Yeah,
about a month ago. It was a fascinating program, and the great big hulking guy walking down the streets there, knowing full well that there are probably dozens of mobsters who would just love to take him out. Is there a contract on him? Do you know?
I think that there's. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a dollar figure attached to it. I think the mob wants him dead. It's not a question of somebody be paid for it. It's just what he's done. You know. Somebody will take him out if they get a chance to.
But even some of the dons, you mentioned that even one of the heads of the Casa Nostra there eventually turned state's evidence, a man who was so critical of these other people, and then when push came to shove, why, he turned state's evidence on everybody. And didn't he eventually go to prison, but for a shorter term?
Well, that's Ralph Natale. This was the boss that Previty answered to. Previty taped a series of drug deals that Natale authorized. Natale was indicted on drug dealing, was looking at a life sentence, and agreed to cooperate. Became the first sitting mafia boss in America to cooperate. He's testified at several trials. He's still in jail right now, has not been sentenced yet, but he's hoping to get a substantial reduction in his sentence as a result of his cooperation.
But he was actually in jail before and going right along with, you know, ordering various people killed when he was in prison, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He was trying to run the family from prison, and he's a twice-convicted drug dealer already, so, I mean, his history is drugs. And it's just the nature of these guys. I mean, they do what they know, and they keep repeating what has been successful for them, successful in the sense of what's generated money for them. All of them end up, I mean, the lesson in all of this is you end up dead or in jail. And Previty, you know, Previty's beaten that by cooperating. He's able to walk away.
And I think it's the most incredible thing that here's a man who's it beats people up. Of course, you know, to see this guy coming, you'd be scared to death, too.
He's an imposing individual, absolutely. And you know, 300 pounds, 6 foot, a shaved head. And, again, to come back to, he's not left the area. He can't disguise himself. He's so recognizable. And when you saw him on 60 Minutes, I mean, he was walking on the boardwalk in Atlantic City in front of one of the casinos. It's not even hiding in plain sight. This guy can't hide.
Well, now, the casinos in Atlantic City still pretty well dominated by the mob, or have they pretty well cleaned things up?
No, I don't think that the casinos themselves have ever been dominated by the mob. It's been some of the service industries, some of the unions that supply casino workers. That's where the mob has had a hook in Atlantic City. A lot of that's been cleaned up, but you know, the mob is always looking for a new gambit down there, whether it's running junkets, whether it's, sports betting is still illegal. But there are lots of high rollers in Atlantic City who come to Atlantic City to gamble, who, if they want to get a bet down on a baseball game, a football game, a boxing match, there's the mob has a bookmaker in every casino, sitting at the bar, sitting in, you know, at a restaurant. If you need to find somebody to get action down on a sporting event, the mob will be there to take your action.
And that was really what's so interesting to me, is the mob really dealt primarily with the people who were involved with illegal activities. If you weren't involved with illegal activities, they usually would sort of leave you alone, wouldn't they?
Yeah, generally. But what legalized casino gambling has done is created a whole new group of customers for the mob.
Okay, we're going to be back here in just a moment here, and if you'd like to give us a call, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295.
4-tape set on the JFK assassination. It includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination, a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president, and then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this four-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time I want to tell you about the Berkey water filters that we carry. We carry the Big Berkey water filter. We carry the Berkey Light. Big Berkey is made out of stainless steel. You can run about 24 gallons of water through it a day. You put the water in the top, comes out the bottom after having gone through the ceramic filters filled with activated carbon, and they to pull out most of the impurities, most of the herbicides and pesticides and the bacteria and all those things. And, of course, takes out the chlorine taste, does a great job of cleaning up the water. And it won't put out fluoride. You have to get special post filters for fluoride, arsenic, and lead. But those are available through Radio Liberty. Now, this is $279. They're very durable. They've been used for 150 years by missionaries. That's the Big Berkey. They're available in every state in the Union except California and Iowa. Now, you can actually get the Berkey Light here in California. It's made of Lexan, so you can actually see the water level. You can't see that in the stainless steel one. The filters work much more efficiently. They're called Black Berkey filters. In fact, we call them water purifiers, and they do a tremendous job of removing everything in there that you don't want in the water while leaving the minerals that you do want there. The thing is that the Black Berkey filters have to be changed every 2 to 3 years, depending on how much you use them. You can get the post filters for that as well. Whether you get the Berkey Light for $199 plus $10 shipping, or the Big Berkey for $279 plus $10 shipping, whichever one you get, why, you'll get a four-tape set or video we produce. If you buy it through us, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the Berkey water filters. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and it's really fascinating as you see how efficient our FBI is. And one reason I wanted to talk about this book, Last Gangster, if you get into the background, the FBI knew everything about what every one of these mobsters was doing. They had infiltrated their organizations. They had taps on their telephones. They were listening to their conversations from prison. They were tapping their conversations or taping their conversations when they went to see their lawyer. We have a very, very efficient FBI, and really it's beautifully laid out in this book on The Last Gangster. Mr. Anastasia, back there. Do we have you back?
Yes, I'm here.
Sure. All right, fine.
Well, we got cut off there for a second.
Oh, well, those things happen. That's one of the problems with electronics. We're not as efficient as the FBI is, that's for sure. And so, hey, really, as you talked to Big Ron Pervetti, you get this feeling that he's just going to continue living his life. He's going to stay there. Don't you think they're going to get him eventually?
Well, I think that's a risk he's running by staying in this area. And as long as he decides to stay in this area, I think he's in danger of being whacked, as they say. I think ultimately Prevetti's going to have to decide to leave the area. I don't know if and when he'll reach that point, but I think if he's going to survive, he's going to have to get out of this general area. He's just too well known.
And you, Christian, talk about the mob killings and shootings, and even on the freeway there, they were out to get one of the people. In fact, I think that Previty wasn't driving the car that day, although he ordinarily did, and there was one of the mobsters, and another gang comes right up next to them on the freeway, full of cars, and they just start spraying this car with bullets right there in the downtown Philadelphia on the freeway.
It was 7:30 in the morning in the middle of rush hour traffic, a six-lane highway. Cars, 50 miles an hour, virtually bumper to bumper, and two mafia hitmen in a van are strafing the side of a Cadillac in which the mafia boss and his son are riding. Yeah, it was probably the most notorious hit and the most wantonly violent and crazy hit in Philadelphia mob history. I mean, fortunately, no innocent people were hurt that morning, but there were literally hundreds of commuters who were in jeopardy and didn't realize it.
Well, of course, we've all seen these movies of The Godfather and the some of De Niro's films, and you have this feeling, well, that's not really the way the world is, but this is the way the world was there in Philadelphia, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was at a certain point in the middle of the mob war in the mid-1990s. It was outrageous what was going on. It was the Wild West.
And we're really talking about 10 years ago.
Yeah, and Ron Previty was right in the middle of that. He was an FBI informant, and was a member of the mafia at the time this was going on. So he's given up information trying to help the FBI thwart some of these murders at the same time that Previty is a target of the other faction of the mob that's out there shooting at his faction. So it was it's a pretty precarious kind of situation.
And you even describe one place where one of the mob faction goes over to a restaurant just opening in the morning where they're going to whack this fellow. And this is all caught on the FBI video camera.
That's the only, to my knowledge, and I think this is correct, it's the only mob hit ever picked up on audio and videotape. It's the FBI recorded a mafia hit in progress. Happened 6 o'clock in the morning as this mob figure was opening this delicatessen that he operated. It's kind of grainy and shadowy. You can't identify the hitmen, but the entire hit goes down on camera.
And of course, this man did survive, although he was never able to really return to the crime scene. And he was being hit because they thought he'd hit somebody else, and maybe he did.
Well, yeah, and that was the situation. I mean, if you get into the book, you get into the story. But it was brother against brother. This was one brother ordering another brother murdered because of this kind of internecine power struggle that was going on. And each brother was with a different faction of the Philadelphia mob. I mean, the whole idea of honor, loyalty, and family, goes by the boards here. This was literally blood against blood.
And I thought the point that you made in your book was that they simply destroyed the gene pool, and new generation coming down the line really wasn't very smart. In fact, it was the contention of Previty that he recognized that these people weren't anywhere near as smart as he was.
Yeah, that's part of why, at least that's part of his explanation for why he did what he did. Basically, he said, when I made it to the top of the organization, I realized either they were going to kill me, I was going to kill them, or we all were going to end up in jail. And so I cut my deal with the FBI. And I mean, I say this a lot when I talk about this, as an Italian-American, I mean, I think one of the things, it's kind of sociological, but if you look at the American mafia, Cosa Nostra, and one of the reasons it's come apart is that second and third generation Italian-Americans, the best and the brightest are doctors, lawyers, and educators, and you're kind of scraping the bottom of the gene pool in terms of the guys that are going into organized crime today. Back in the 20s, the 10s, the 20s, the 30s, those guys who became mafia bosses, they brought a degree of intelligence and sophistication to what they were doing. I'm not justifying their decision to become mafioso, but I think back in those days, there were certain doors that were closed to Italian-Americans. There were certain prejudices that don't exist today. And you could... You can understand, at least there's an explanation for why those guys became gangsters. Today, you look around America from Anton Scalia to Martin Scorsese, from Rudy Giuliani to Jason Giambi, you're going to find an Italian-American at the top of almost any field of endeavor. There are no doors closed on us. So those guys that are going into the organized crime are guys that can or won't do anything else. And they don't have the level of intelligence and sophistication that the old-time gangsters had. And that's contributed in large degree, I think, to why the whole organization's come apart at the seams.
And I think it's really fascinating as you read this, and you have a very, very readable story of the history of the Philadelphia Mafia over a period of, 35, 40 years?
Yeah, and the point I'm trying to make is not just... The Philadelphia mob, I think, is a microcosm of the American Mafia. And if you want to understand why it's come apart, this is a good example. If you read this story, you're going to get a sense of why this organization is no longer monolithic, why it's no longer dominant in the underworld. And I think what's happened in Philadelphia is, you mentioned Boston as another example. I think it's happened in Cleveland, in Detroit, Kansas City, to a lesser degree in New York, but it's also happened in New York. Everywhere where the American Mafia has operated, these kind of things, this internecine power struggle, the violence, the lack of sophistication, the mob informants, the wiretaps, the electronic surveillance, all of that has been in play, and it's happening all over the country.
Well, now, what about Las Vegas? Is that pretty clean as far as you know?
I think the casino industry in Las Vegas, in Atlantic City, almost everywhere else, it's corporate America today. And so you're not going to find the mob in the counting room anymore. But where you're going to find the mob is on the fringes, whether they can run junkets, whether they can control the suppliers of linens, of foodstuffs, whether they can siphon off customers to their own gambling operations, prostitution, drugs, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, the new pitch in Vegas, you know, what happens here stays here. What you're talking about are human vices, what goes on there. Well, you know, the mob is going to be supplying some of the vice that people seek when they're out there in Vegas or when they're in Atlantic City. If it's not legalized prostitution, there's going to be prostitution, and the mob's going to have a piece of that. Cocaine, drugs, the mob will have a piece of that. In Atlantic City, poker is, you know, poker for a long time was not a game that was legalized, so the mob had poker games in rooms in the casinos. I mentioned sports betting. Sports betting is still illegal in Atlantic City, but the mob has bookies in every casino. It's all those kind of things, yeah. They're still very much a presence in the casino industry, even though I don't think there's any indication they control the casinos themselves.
Now, what about the unions? Are they pretty big in some of the unions across America, you think?
The Philadelphia mob, in the early days of the casino gambling era in Atlantic City, controlled the hotel and bartenders union, and that became the largest union in Atlantic City. And only after the federal government came in and seized the local and put a monitor in place were they able to get the mob out of there. In the early days of the casino gambling in Atlantic City, from, say, 1978, when the first casino opened, through about 1989, the mob had its hooks into the biggest and most lucrative labor organization in the city. Now, you know, they've gotten them out of there, but, you know, the mob will... When the mob is on top of its game, when it's doing and operating the way it used to operate, it'll push and poke and see where it can make inroads, and if it finds resistance, it'll back away and push and poke somewhere else. That's the way they usually operate. You know, the whole idea of this is lines. I think these younger guys kind of caught that John Gotti syndrome. They wanted to be celebrity gangsters. This is the kind of thing that turned Previty off. These guys don't want to call attention to themselves, look at me, I'm a gangster, that kind of thing. And, you know, those kind of things contributed to the demise of the organization.
And, of course, the impression that I get reading your book was that the dons who were really effective were the ones who just stayed in the background, didn't rock the boat, didn't try to get a lot of headlines. They just collected their money.
That's what it's about. It's a secret. It's supposed to be a secret society. And some of these old-time guys, look at these young kids that are, you know, in the headlines and on television and always calling attention to themselves, and they're saying, who are these guys? What do they think they're doing? You know? And the older guys don't get it. I mean, they understand it. Not for nothing is it called a secret society, you know?
All right, let's go to Ben, who's calling in. Ben, does you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do, and I'd like to thank Mr. Anastasia for separating the myth from the reality of Mafia life, because many people are ignorant. I grew up with Italians, so I know what the game is, and he's very accurate. My question is this. Mr. Anastasia, I have heard through many media sources that the biggest going and active and violent mafia in America today is the Russian mafia. Is there any truth in this?
I think there's a lot of people in law enforcement who believe that to be true. And the way it's been explained to me is I've talked to people investigating Russian organized crime, and they say trying to figure out who these Russians are and what they're doing is comparable to back in the 1920s when law enforcement was trying to figure out who these Sicilians were and what they were doing. The Russians primarily stay within their own ethnic community. They hide behind a language barrier, and they're within a community where even law-abiding citizens don't trust and won't cooperate with law enforcement. So they're still in that ethnic cocoon that first-generation immigrants surround themselves with for good and for bad. And I think that's where we are with the Russians today.
Yeah, considering today's technology, that's a pretty scary proposition, sir.
Oh, absolutely. And the other thing about the Russians that I found is that they seem to be playing at a much more sophisticated level than in the mafia in the early
days. Exactly.
They're doing international things.
I've heard that they're very, very violent. You know, you get in their way, they whack you without...
They like to dispose of their bodies in these inland obscure lakes.
Yeah.
All right. Good question, Ben. Thank you so much. All right, fine. I think that's, you do away with one ethnic group and somebody else is always coming back to create problems. It seems that there is just this inherent evil in certain people that always is going to come out against the mores of society.
Well, I think a vacuum is created and somebody fills that vacuum. And in the underworld, I think it's almost the law of supply and demand or economics. And in the underworld, the same laws hold true. If the American mafia loses strength and power and influence, somebody is going to pick it up, and I think the Russians are a group worth watching in terms of, are they going to fill that void?
But of course, if men weren't out looking for hookers, and if the wealthy people weren't trying to place illegal bets, why the mafia would be in real trouble?
Well, it's the human condition, though. I mean, that stuff is biblical. It's never going to change. It's just part of human nature, I guess.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That's sort of one of our stresses here, that a lot of this is biblical. There's evil in men, and you got to recognize that. But this is what the mafia feeds on. And
absolutely, yeah.
All right, fine. Well, we're just about out of time. We've only got a couple of minutes before we have to wrap this program up. What's the real message that you want to get out through this book of yours? Other than the fact that people should read The Last Gangster by George Anastasia, a great read, a tremendous insight into the mafia, and I learned what I did not realize is that the mafia, is at least the Sicilian mafia, is becoming increasingly an impotent force in our society.
Well, I think that's the message. The mafia, the American mafia, Cosa Nostra, as this monolithic underworld institution, is no more. I mean, it's gone, it's over. I mean, Previti's best line in all of that is, he saw it right away. He said, you'd have to be Ray Charles not to see it. It's done. And the glamorization of the mob, in the movies and in books, that is a myth. And the reality is, these are low-level thugs, and there's no honor or loyalty anymore, and there's nothing glamorous about that life.
And he came along just 20 years too late then.
Exactly.
All right, fine. Well, I want to thank you very much for writing the book, and how can people get copies of it?
It should be at any bookstore. Amazon.com has it, BarnesandNoble.com. It came out about 3 weeks ago, and it's on most lists and most bookstores that ought to be available.
All right, fine. Well, I'm going to talk to your publicist. Incidentally, you have the best publicist in the country, Donna Gould. She really is wonderful. I'm going to get you on to some of our other programs. We do three different audiences today. I want all of them to hear this story and to learn what I've learned from reading your book. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that was George Anastasia. And, of course, I think you have to learn from reading the book how efficient our Federal Bureau of Investigation is. And then, of course, the question is, they're so good in getting the mafia, why couldn't they find out who the terrorists were here in our country? Well, part of this was because anybody who was in the FBI who wanted to investigate the Islamic terrorists was blocked. But somebody was investigating them. I don't know. Well, you see, we have about 12 or 14 different intelligence organizations in the United States. And those of you who got my March newsletter know that. And we simply list all these various intelligence agencies. That was the February newsletter. And you can get that up on our webpage at radioliberty.com. And you'll find out that all of these intelligence agencies are out there. And so whether it was the CIA, which, contrary to what you've been told about them not being able to operate in here, has been operating in the United States for a long period of time. And in my March newsletter, I simply quote from General William Odom, who for a number of years was in charge of NSA, known affectionately as No Such Agency. It's the National Security Agency, the most secret of the secret organizations. So he knew all the secrets. And in his book, Affixing Intelligence, which I quote in my March newsletter, which you need to get, he simply asked the questions, should the CIA be allowed to carry out assassinations? Should the CIA be allowed to have journalists working in the media? Should the Army be able to collect dossiers on American citizens? should the CIA budget be publicly known about? And elsewhere he talks about the CIA having their agents in our media. Now, this is a violation of the law, but these people are above the law. They have funds from all sorts of sources, and in part it's from smuggling drugs. And if you don't think that the CIA, at least in years past, worked with the mafia, now the FBI did not, other than what you heard about today, where they would give people a get-out-of-jail-free card as long as they told them what was going on, but the CIA worked with the mafia dons. If you haven't read the book Double Cross, We Carry It, it's written by the brother of Sam Giancano, Chuck Giancano. You need to get this book. You need to read it. You need to understand that the CIA was working with Sam Giancano at the same time he was sleeping with the same woman that John Kennedy was sleeping with. It's the most incredible story, but it's also the story of how the CIA carried out assassinations for mafia carried out assassinations for the CIA, and of course they've worked together, drugs smuggling right here in the United States. The book is Double Cross, available by calling 1-800-544-8927.
Our four tape set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination, a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of an American president, and then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this four tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Let me tell you about some of the other items that we carry, and certainly one of them would be Phonopoly. Phonopoly is a game. You play it just like you play Monopoly, but you actually have the opportunity then to get property, but in the process you're learning how to pronounce words. You're learning the sounds of the English language. You're learning the rules of the English language. In about 16 hours of playing these various games, you can learn how to spell phonetically and read phonetically and pronounce words phonetically. It's a great program. It's not one board game. It's actually five board games and two bonus games. We recommend this. Most of these programs are $300, $400, $500, $600. This one is $139.95. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and ask about Phonopoly. And then we want to mention the Institute of the Constitution. It's a program designed to teach you and your friends about the most carefully kept secret in America, and that is that America was created as a Christian nation. Now, you can learn about Phonopoly by going to their website at iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com, the Institute of the Constitution online.com, or calling them at 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068. And get a Institute kit, and then, of course, it's 12 half-hour lectures on the Constitution, a couple of extra lectures by David Barton, and there's a kit that comes with that that you can ask questions. You need to learn that America was founded by Christians on Christian principles. Our law was based upon the Bible, but you're not taught that today. Get an organization today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do. 5 hours a day reaching out across America, reaching out really across the world, because we have listeners in England and Europe and Australia and South Africa. So if you'd like to know more about our ministry, go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. If you'd like to get a free copy of our newsletter, why you do that, simply by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. And the March newsletter will tell you what happened at the secret cabinet meetings held in the White House in January and February of the year 2001. That was 8 to 9 months before the September 11th attack. You'll be shocked at what they were discussing at that time. And so much other information you'll get in our newsletters, you're just not going to get any other place. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free newsletter, go to our website at radioliberty.com. And, of course, the newsletters will be up there in another week or so. And you have our permission to pull down the newsletters, to copy them, to distribute them, to listen to our programs there on the Radio Liberty Network, 3 hours a day, on the Genesis Network, 2 hours a day, and there are links to the other networks where you can listen to our programs, and then the programs are archived, at least the Radio Liberty programs are archived. Tell other people about our radio programs. Tell them about our website. Get them listening. And, of course, we're now 4 hours a day on shortwave. I want to mention there's a conspiracy conference. It's going to be held in Santa Clara here in California, right across the hills from where I live. It's going to be on May 29th and May 30th. That's Memorial Day weekend. If you'd like to go, the telephone number is 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. I'm not going to be speaking. I did speak last year, but Joyce Riley will be there, Len Horowitz, and Eric Huffschmidt and Rodney Stitz. A lot of good people are going to be there. I think you'll find it fascinating. I will be there. We'll have a booth. And I think that you'll learn a lot about the things that are going on that you're not going to hear elsewhere. That's the Conspiracy Conference, Memorial Day weekend, 29th, 30th. And again, the telephone number, 209-832-0999. Or go to their website at conspiracycon.com. So then we want to mention the book that I read, The Brotherhood of Darkness. And if you read this book, why, you'll never look at the world through quite the same eyes again. You can get the book by itself for $12.95, or you can get the book and the video and the audio tape for $29.95. You can get my video, The Iraq, the Untold Story. It will give you the documentation for the fact that all of the wars of the last century were fought for far different reasons than the boys we sent overseas to die, we're told. And we'll give you the documents. We actually have a syllabus that goes with us, and you'll see many of the original documents, the letters that were written, letters that I found in my research, the ambassador from Germany writing to Colonel House back in 1936 saying, why are American industrialists building up the military of Adolf Hitler's Germany when we have exchange controls? They can't get any money out. You'll see the article out of the Chicago Tribune, a copy of it, signed there at the very day that they signed the treaty in Tokyo Harbor, mentioning the Japanese had been trying to surrender for 6 months. We wouldn't let them. We didn't have to invade Okinawa or Iwo Jima or drop the bombs. Somebody just wanted as many people to die as possible. You need to get the syllabus. You need to see the documentation. You need to watch the video, Iraq, the Untold Story. You need to get our syllabus on sustainable development and how this whole concept of environmentalism is being used to centralize power in Washington, and not only in Washington, but with world government, because the solution to all the problems facing America today is a new series of international laws and the end of American sovereignty and the end of freedom, all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival and for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.